extraordinary humanity of the music.
He was a brilliant talent, a true genius, but he was writing music to pay the bills. But his pain, his anguish, has left us with this extraordinarily rich musical legacy.
The genius of Mozart.
The thing I really love about Mozart is his curiosity. Every time he gets to a crossroads, he turns a different way. You never know where you are with him.
The genius of Mozart. Every note he wrote. January the 1st to the 12th on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's quarter to midnight, time for Jazz Line Up with Kevin Legendre.
Good evening, welcome to Jazz Line Up with me, Kevin Legendre. Tonight we're thinking big. We're celebrating the orchestral side of jazz, and we feature two great exponents of contemporary big band music, Guy Barker and Tommy Smith, recorded in conversation at this year's London Jazz Festival. Throughout the show, we'll be looking at various highlights of the history of big band jazz, but to get the ball rolling, we have some music from one of the founding fathers, so to speak, Duke Ellington. This is The Waltz You Save For Me. The master himself, Duke Ellington, with The Waltz You Save For Me, taken from a 1962 album with a provocative title, Will the Big Bands Ever Come Back? Well, even though they've become increasingly difficult to keep going since their heyday in the 20s and 30s, big bands are still with us today. And this year's London Jazz Festival highlighted that with a wealth of great big band music that included D'Arcy James Argue, Orchestre National du Jazz, and the East London Creative Jazz Orchestra. I was around to meet two band leaders, Guy Barker and Tommy Smith, also presenting music at the festival with their own orchestras, featuring special guests such as John Scofield. We talked about the orchestral side of jazz in front of an audience at the front room in the foyer of the Queen Elizabeth Hall at the South Bank Centre. Let's start with a very practical question. You're both working very hard for the Jazz Festival, doing lots of different things. How much preparation does it take if you've got an orchestra at your disposal and you're preparing for a concert? How much work do you have to do? How much work goes into it before you actually get up on stage and do it? Tommy.
Well, we started our John Scofield project in March, where we played four concerts in Scotland. So we all had to get the music commissioned. That took about 6 months from 10 different composers. And it takes a long time. We're really lucky with that. We've already performed all the music we're going to play this week. So we're very relaxed and not uptight or stressed out, because we've done all the work months ago and we're just refreshing it. So we're in a very ideal position just to think about the music. If it was back in March, where we were playing with John for the first time with the orchestra, then it was a very different situation, because we just rehearsed solidly for days and days. And when you premiere music, it's quite stressful, but that's all out the way. So we're going to have fun, like we did last night in Finchley.
Guy, you did Jazz Voice, which launched the London Jazz Festival on Friday. Which, did anybody go to Jazz Voice, by the way? Yeah, we have a show of hands. You went to Jazz Voice? Okay. Which was a great show, I'm sure you'll agree. It's very, very exciting. You had nine different singers. You're celebrating a tradition of song in jazz with an orchestra and a string orchestra as well. So you had brass, reeds, rhythm section and strings. A lot of people on stage. Mm-hmm. How much work went into that? When did you actually start the production process for that?
Well, we have a 42-piece orchestra. And I suppose I start thinking about it in March, because we have to get a program made up of songs that have a reason for being there. In other words, have an anniversary, have some kind of connection with this year. Because that way, it kind of gives you a straitjacket. Because otherwise, you know, you just look at every song there is and you wouldn't know where to start. So we give us this restriction. And so eventually we find a number of songs that we can do, and then we start making calls to various singers to see what they would like to sing. And a lot of the time I would say to them, I really would like you to sing this one song. Now, here's all the other opportunities and songs you can choose from, and eventually we get that together. But I suppose this year was particularly problematic, and the opposite of what Tommy was talking about just now, because I had to write a piece, a concerto for Martin Taylor, the guitarist, and that's for a 50-piece orchestra and his group, which is being premiered on Friday. So along with 22 arrangements for Jazz Voice, I had that going, and I started on the 1st of March.
So no pressure then?
No, and it was all day, every day, until last Sunday. And it's a long process. And Tommy, as you will, knows full well about this, and we've worked together a lot and often talked about the composing process and arranging process. And sometimes it comes a little easier. Sometimes an orchestration of, say, 5 or 6 minutes can actually take only a couple of days, but sometimes it can go on and on and on. You can be fighting away in your mind trying to get a proper introduction, and it takes a long time, and then eventually it comes. But, you know, my trumpet was in the corner whimpering at me like a dog that hadn't been taken for a walk for ages, and it still is at the moment.
Tommy, has your saxophone been whimpering in the corner like a dog?
No. Even if I'm composing, I have this rule. I have to play it first. And I had a similar project starting in December last year, where I had to work flat out for 4 months doing a piece for three taiko drummers and the orchestra, based on these Japanese folk songs and Shinto gods. And it was head down. But if you do get stuck into composition day after day after day, you get into a routine, but you do neglect your instrument. And I can't do that, because I feel really guilty.
Oh, I felt guilty too.
We have jazz guilt already. Yeah. Only 10 minutes into the conversation. But tell us about, I'm really interested in how you plan and how you pace yourself over that amount of time, because we're talking, as Guy said, the long haul.
You know, I delegate a lot of work to other writers.
Right.
If I do one project, I like to do the big stuff, because I've done the small stuff for years, and I like to get a big challenge. So, yeah, 2 hours, fine, let's do 2 hours. But we have a great stable of composers from all over the world, and we try and suit the piece for them, and they are always very excited about writing for our guest artists like Gary Burton, and we just did an ECM project with Harold Anderson. In fact, I had called up Guy, asked him if he... Hey, Guy, you want to do Pat Metheny's Bright Side's Life? And he thought about it for a day or two and said, no, I'm sorry, I'm too busy, because he was busy writing his own music. And there are fabulous composers out there, and I think... You know, delegation is the art of timekeeping. And if you want to have more time for yourself, just delegate it and share out the work. And you get a project which is quite diverse, but you have to be quite strict about giving them strict guidelines, or else you might get them writing all for the same soloist. Like for 1 year, I had 10 pieces composed for the orchestra, and I had all the solos, and that's not right. So we had to share... I've got to say, maybe with the guest artists, it would be great to have a trombone solo in this one or a piano solo. So we're quite strict that way, but very loose at the same time.
There's something quite important, though, about... you're talking about the process of writing there and for different... when you get a large ensemble, especially when it goes up to 42, one of the things that comes into it and screams at you is a thing called economics. And so what you often hear is, well, you can't actually have four lots of rehearsals, you can only have the one day. So, because it's an expensive thing to put on. So what that does is it means that when you think you've finished an arrangement, you have to go right back to the beginning and mark every note, whether it's short, long, every phrase mark, everything. You have to be meticulous. And Tommy, for example, is extremely meticulous. I've played his music a lot. And you have to get into that. It's true. And
don't tell anybody these things.
Well, you disagree.
But you do. And the reason is because if you're sitting in the rehearsal and you've got 6 hours to get 22 songs together, and the third trumpet player puts his hand up and he says, Guy, bar 45, everybody seems to have that note long but me. What is that? Okay. Oh, no, yeah, that should be long. And is that supposed to be a flat? Now, you've just lost 30 seconds. And if 42 people do that, your day is going to disappear. So that means the only way you can do is make your preparation even greater. And that does also include, in my case, I know, worrying and waking up at 3 a.m. thinking, I'm not going to get this done. So you just get up and you start writing. I've done that a few times, where you get up at 3 in the morning and write until about 10 and then fall asleep. You know, that kind of thing goes on.
Tommy, is that kind of attention to detail? I mean, Guy's talking about what might be happening on bar 45. Presumably there'll be something else which is equally intriguing happening on bar 250 or whatever it may be. Very, very meticulous, very, very precise, especially when you have so many different elements that you're dealing with, 20 or 42 pieces. Is that the greatest challenge that you have in that environment with big band music?
Well, composers who spend a lot of time writing the music really have to spend an extra day finalizing. There's a lot of people who rush and they give you a piece which is blank almost. It has the notes but nothing else. And we need rehearsal marks, we need the tempo marks to be clear, we need every phrasing and articulation and dynamic there, and it's got to be perfect, and it also has to be very easy to read, and because each minute costs a fortune. You know, and if you're busy fixing something, you're wasting time on the music. And I'm famous for changing people's music as well, which is something I'm not proud of. But sometimes
do you do that at the last minute?
Yeah, I mean, we changed a few things today. it's to make the music flow better. A lot of people who write music, they use computer programs, and they can play anything. But when it comes to the human being, sometimes you just have to say, wait a minute, let's just try this, and if it's better, we'll do it. And we usually tell the composer that we're going to do that, but sometimes we don't have time, and they come along and go, I didn't recognize that piece.
Because I think, wasn't it Joe Henderson who said that the art of big band is, or the art of the orchestra is having a big band with all the power that also has the flexibility of a quartet? So presumably, having flexibility, being able to move, being able to change things at the last minute, which is an important part of the whole jazz aesthetic, you still have to retain that, even though you're working in this very, very precise, very very detailed context.
Yeah, you hit something there which I'm very passionate about, and that's that the quartet within the big band, it really has to be a very strong element there. And in fact, the quartet in our big band, or at least the trio, it's my own band now. And they're very, very powerful musicians. And when you put all the other pieces together, there's a unity there, which is really important.
Is that rhythm section like a core around which the other things revolve?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of big bands you hear all over the world. The weakest elements are sometimes the rhythm section. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's really important that the rhythm section is the strongest element.
Guy, do you have similar feelings about maybe having a center or a core with the rhythm section and then these other parts layered on top of it?
Absolutely. It's the central bit. They call it it's the engine room, you know. Mm. But I think there has to be a link to the leaders in each one of the sections. Because it's a bit like, you know, if a band starts speeding up or slowing down, it's amazing how often people would turn around and glare at the drummer. It's not always to do with him. It's everybody
else. Don't
always
blame the drummer.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It's just not fair. But I always think the other thing is, of course, that when you look at a pile of music, you know, ultimately it's just dots on a piece of paper, and it's not until you put it into the hands of great musicians, and they sometimes tell you how it should go. And that's a bit like when Tommy was saying about changing things. Often, you know, people will say, you know, I've got an idea for this particular bar. Would it be better if I did this?
So you've got to respond to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're the people that are going to play it. And so you say, well, let's try it. And sometimes, you learn something from that. And the piece can grow, and also all the members of the band, the orchestra, whatever, they feel more part of it. And I think also, like Tommy has a regular group of musicians that he works with, and so do I. And I find that I start writing for the individual players. And sometimes it does mean that if I take my music to somewhere else, for example, if you have five saxophones, the doubling that generally happens, usually, you might have the alto sax players doubling on flute, and the tenor sax players may double on clarinet, and the baritone will double on bass clarinet. But in the band I use, the strongest flute player is on the first tenor. Mm. And so that my doubles are all over the place because I'm writing for them individually. And I write for the first and second trumpet players slightly differently. Sometimes they swap leads, sometimes, and it's because it's for specific people. And I think as if you do that too, again, people feel that it's not my band, it's our band. And that breathes a different kind of feeling into it.
Is that what you've been developing at the Scottish National Jazz Orchestra as well, having those really strong personalities that you're in communication with? Because what Guy is talking about really goes right back to Ellington writing for Hodges, knowing the strengths of his musicians, the idiosyncrasies.
Yeah, it's the way we do it too. When we give our three sheets of paper instructions to our composers, every musician's listed and all the strengths are listed, and of course all their doubling, which is a little bit different from other big bands. We have flute on first tenor, soprano on second tenor, then we have clarinet and soprano on first alto, soprano and alto, and then baritone and bass clarinet. There's very few clarinets in there, very few flutes. If we need more flutes, I just call up the people in the symphony orchestra because they make such a better sound than jazz musicians. So, for example, in August there, we were doing a project with Günther Schuller, and he wanted to do, what was it again? It was a Gil Evans piece. It wasn't Miles Ahead, wasn't Sketches of Spain. It was Porgy and Bess. And so we had three flautists and three clarinetists and three French horn players from the symphony orchestra. And it's fantastic, the sound they make.
I mean, what you're talking about really is what is orchestral woodwind players, where that is their instrument, so they live with it daily. But there are a lot of saxophone players that I know whose doubles are very good. I mean, but the great thing about doing something like jazz voice or having those forces is it gives you the chance to do absolutely what you want. And one of the arrangements I did this year, we actually had five alto flutes on, which was the most glorious sound I've heard, and I've never heard anybody use five alto flutes, but I looked down, I said, well, I can do it, I've got it, you know, they're there, so let's use it.
Well, as Guy Barker points out, lots of novel sounds can be created by an orchestra. So let's hear an example of just how rich the textures can be. This is the Tom Richards Orchestra, a 21-piece outfit featuring great soloists such as vibraphonist Jim Hart, pianist Gwilym Simcock, and soprano and tenor saxophonist and composer Tom Richards. This piece is called Liquor Bickering and features Gareth Loughrane on flute and Trevor Myers on trombone. Thank you. Tom Richards Orchestra's Liquor Bickering from the album Smoke and Mirrors. That was released by Candid Records in 2007. If you've just joined us, this is Jazz Lineup and we're celebrating big band jazz. And we return to the conversation that we recorded with Guy Barker and Tommy Smith at this year's London Jazz Festival.
Could the big band be the musician's ultimate plaything, his kind of dream, whereby you can create all of these different colours and textures, as Guy said, maybe something that you haven't heard before because of all the elements that you have?
I think so. I like to challenge composers and give them a basic big band and see if they can come up with something different just with the ordinary five saxophones, trombones and trumpets. See what they can do with that first. All these exotic instruments can really spice up the music very easily, although it is a knack and a technique to know how to write for them. But like our piece we did recently with the three taiko drummers, I mean, who would ever have thought to put three taiko drummers with a big band? It's never been done before, and probably for good reason, too. But the power of those big drums, the big old daiko drum and a big band together is phenomenal. And, you know, they have little bells and they can make subtle sounds as well, but you have some strange combinations out there that are yet to be found, I'm quite sure.
Okay, we're going to take a little musical break and actually listen to an example of some of Guy's work with a big band. He did a project called Amadeus, the Amadeus Project, a while ago. And we're going to listen to a piece called A Guy, Three Chicks and a Big Snake. Guy, can you tell us about this particular project and that very intriguing title?
Well,
it's not a reference to yourself, is it?
The piece was commissioned during the 250th anniversary of Mozart's birth, and I'd been asked to go to San Diego to write some music for a festival out there called the Mainly Mozart Festival for a nine-piece group. And when I came back, I was commissioned by the BBC to do something for the festival, so I thought, well, if I stick with the Mozart idea, and I... obviously, there's none of Mozart's music there. I mean, you wouldn't touch that. The last, you know, the worst thing you can ever do is jazz up the classics. I think the only time it ever worked was, wasn't it, when Strayhorn and Ellington did the Nutcracker, and that seemed to work, you know. But so the idea was I took the story of the Magic Flute, which makes no sense at all, and I gave it to a friend of mine who's a crime writer. And he rewrote it as if it was set in New York in the 50s and Mickey Spillane had written it. And then he gave me the story. And the original intention for it was supposed to be a ballet. It was supposed to be something that was danced. So he gave me a set of titles and told me what was going on. And I wrote music to it. And this is, I think, is the very opening of it. I think the guy, the three chicks and the big snake, is because at the beginning of the opera, there's the prince is being attacked by a giant snake, and he's rescued by three ladies. He referred to them. He said in the original story, there were three ladies in waiting, and in our version, there are three ladies in wanting. So.
Okay. So from Mozart to Mickey Spillane to operas with snakes.
Yeah.
Let's hear a little bit of The Amadeus Project by Guy Barker.
Thank you.
That was A Guy, Three Chicks and a Big Snake by Guy Barker. Guy, without going into too much detail, because we don't have that much time, where would you actually start with a piece like that?
Well, I think that's the very opening of the piece. So the idea was it had to be something hard and something to hit you in the face and begin the whole thing. And it had to have a kind of filmic quality to it as well. But I actually remember writing the ideas for that in my local pub. I remember couldn't think of anything. I went round and I had a pint of bitter and sat there and started scribbling ideas down. And I looked at Mozart's original opera and I realised that he had a joke going through it, which was the number three that always appeared. And the opening started with the same three chords as the piece ended, and it's in E flat, which has three flats. And there's a whole series of adventures that go on, and eventually they get to where these temples are. And I sort of likened the idea of the temple to pyramids. So I thought, well, if in my overture I'll start with the idea of three pyramids and see where that gets me. So what you hear there is you heard the drum roll, and then you heard the sort of the scale went up and down and then cascaded down. And when you looked at that on the score, it looked like a pyramid. So that piece has, that's where I started.
So imagery is important.
Absolutely,
in terms of visual images. And you mentioned something filmic as well, which is very important, because I was going to say that there's definitely a kind of soundtrack quality to that music. And if you think about some of the great soundtrack composers like Lalo Schifrin and Quincy Jones, they came from a big band tradition as well. So is there an important connection between, let's say, early big band music and the later soundtrack tradition? Tommy, do you think?
The tradition is you can hear it. You can hear it everywhere. You can even hear it in commercials, not just movies. It's everywhere. And if you get into that world, then that's the world you end up in. Film writing is a different genre. It's a lot of hard work, probably underpaid, and a lot of sweat and tears. But it's very must be a great thing to see your music with all these images. But with Guy's music there, you could see lots of things happening. Well, I'd like to see the score. It sounded great. It sounded fantastic. Loved it.
But I mean, I think if you talk to any composer, you know, they'll always talk about how scared they are of the blank page and that first time. I remember talking to Carla Bley. We were on a bus going on tour somewhere, and she explained how she wrote music, and she was saying, well, I wake up in the morning and I put the manuscript paper on the piano, and then I look at it, and then I sharpen some pencils, and then I go out and make a cup of tea, and then I come back and I sharpen some more pencils, and then eventually, and then then she says, oh, it's time for morning coffee, and then it keeps going, and eventually it was like, well, I thought, oh, actually, it's lunchtime, maybe I should have a cocktail now, and it was the whole process of putting it off, and I remember talking to my composition teacher about that, the fear of the blank page, and he said, try and look at other forms of art, whether it's painting or story or something. I mean, if I have a story, then immediately you have an image, and the image conjures up sounds. And for example, I mean, a lot of the stuff I do, I found that really helpful. And I must admit, I got quite a bit of that from Tommy, because when we first worked together in his sextet, he'd written a whole series of pieces that were inspired by the work of a great poet, and also images as well. There were images of creatures and from Scotland and stuff. So in the music you could hear that imagery. So really, a lot of it is storytelling, and I guess film music is storytelling as well. I mean, and you can go back as well as Lalo Schifrin and Quincy Jones. You know, you see that fantastic film with James Stewart in called Anatomy of a Murder.
Ellington did the score.
And there's some fantastic work by people like that. John Williams, for example, was a jazz pianist in New York for a long time. John Barry, he had a jazz septet. John Dankworth, you know, you could go on. There are these people, and I think what happens with jazz musicians particularly is they spend so much of their time studying not only their own form of music but classical music and trying to get different sounds and different colours that, you know, the idea of painting pictures can appeal to a film director, I guess.
Yeah. I believe most people think of me as a band leader. And at the same time, they sort of remember and recognize the fact that I have had good fortune with some hit songs. But I think primarily they think about me as a band leader. And when they think in terms of doing writing for a show or a picture or something like that, they feel that, well, I mean, Ellington's got his band, and I'm sure he wouldn't give that up for anything, you know, and that's it. And they just leave it that way. And I'm sure a lot of people feel that way. And this, of course, doing the score for a picture really calls for being along with the action and absorbing a lot, all of the atmosphere that and everything that's taking place in the picture.
Two pieces that highlight the link between big band jazz and the soundtrack tradition. That was Quincy Jones's interpretation of Henry Mancini's title music for the 1963 film Charade, which, as movie buffs will know, starred Audrey Hepburn and Cary Grant. And just before that, Duke Ellington with the main theme of the classic soundtrack that he did for Otto Preminger's 1959 film Anatomy of a Murder, whose cast included James Stewart and Lee Remick. And in between those two tracks, you heard the voice of Duke Ellington himself talking about what it's like to work on a soundtrack. Film is not the only art form that can inspire great orchestral music. Tora, a recent album by Tommy Smith and the Scottish National Jazz Orchestra, is based on the first five books of the Bible, and it's also inspired by a great musician. Tommy Smith explains its genesis.
My friend Joe Lovano is a tenor player from America. And I wanted to write him a saxophone concerto because I thought the saxophone was a very neglected instrument. It was always the trumpet getting the features, you know, like in Miles Ahead, in Sketches of Spain, and Porgy and Bess. And there weren't many saxophone pieces. So I wrote this 45-minute piece for Lovano in 2000 based on the first five books of the Bible, the Torah, the root of all the religions. And he was cast as this Moses figure and toying with good and evil all the way through the piece. And he ate it up. He loved it. And we toured it in 2000 a long time ago. And I just revised it. The problem is...
So again, we have a story there, which is quite important. You talk about... Lovano actually being cast as a character in the story.
Yeah, if you know Joe, he's a very big guy, and he's got a huge aura and personality, and writing for him is very easy, especially because it was saxophone. I know a bit about that instrument, so I could write for it well. And Joe brought a lot to this piece, but we didn't record it with Joe. He had broken both of his arms on the ice in Germany and Spain, so I decided to take up the reins. I was much cheaper than him as well. I was free.
Well, that's quite a revelation. Tommy Smith is cheaper than Joe Lovano.
I was free.
Live on Radio 3.
You can't be cheaper than free. And we did it in one day, just up in Scotland on a winter's day, one day, and went in and recorded it. And it's fascinating because when I decided to play it, I had to rewrite it to suit me because it really wasn't written for me. So I had to change.
Because you have a different musical
personality. I had to change a few things.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, we're always changing things. Well, I am anyway. You just revise and you revise and you revise and you learn so much. Once you start teaching or getting into research, you end up learning so much, and you look back at old things and you decide, I think I'll better change that. You know, we're always evolving, and it's a good thing, you know, never to be satisfied. But you can live in the moment when you play jazz, but when you're a composer, the moment is very slow.
Sure.
Thank you.
Leviticus from the album Torah by Tommy Smith and the Scottish National Jazz Orchestra. I'm in conversation with two contemporary band leaders, Tommy Smith and Guy Barker.
Guy mentioned Carla Bley, the great Carla Bley. She's done some wonderful arrangements and led some really great big bands over the years. She did the Escalator Over the Hill project, and she's also worked a lot with Charlie Hayden's Liberation Music Orchestra. If we were to look at, let's say, important figures in the whole big band tradition over the years, go right back to, say, Fletcher Henderson, Basie, Ellington, go through the years, Gil Evans, Don Ellis, Carla Bley, Braxton. I mean, it's enormous, the actual diversity. If the two of you had to try to sum up what's been going on in big band over the year, what do you think have been the main developments?
It's very difficult, and this summer we had to try and do the history of the big band in a concert, and it was just so difficult to choose the pieces. And I wrote to many historians and asked them, what would you choose? And it was difficult to pin it down. You would need a very long concert to pay tribute and justice to that. But you missed out the supernatural orchestra. In your list there.
Tell us about the Supernatural Orchestra.
You haven't heard of the Supernatural Orchestra? It's a French orchestra, very wacky, like the French Sun Ra, very extreme in every way. I
like the idea of a French Sun Ra.
But I think Guy is probably going to answer this question better than I, because he's probably more knowledgeable on the history of the big band. We just play it, but I couldn't choose.
I'm going to use that next time. I want to pass the buck. it was funny enough. It's a tricky thing to answer, because it moved alongside the jazz history itself. For every big band that went along, there's an equivalent thing that was going on alongside it. Whether it was, you know, Fletcher Henderson's band, you know, in the 30s, to what Goodman was doing in the swing era and that sound, and to what the Dizzy Gillespie band and the Billy Eckstein band were doing in the bebop era. So it follows it along. And then you have Mingus's big band and the work that came from that and that sound. So really, it kind of went along in parallel with the way that the music moved on. But I mean, you were talking about history of big bands. We did a concert at the Barbican where we did a history of the big band in the UK. And I found that a really fascinating and amazing experience. And I learnt a lot, you know, listening to the music of Spike Hughes and Ray Noble and all those guys from the 20s and the 30s through to the Ted Heath Band. And, you know, Ted Heath Band was a very precise dance band, and yet he still had Tad Dameron writing for him and various people like that. And there are some amazing arrangements that really pushed the boundaries as well. So there was a lot of stuff going on. And then, of course, you go on and into John Dankworth and Mike Westbrook and on and on and on.
Two different generations of great British big band music. We started the sequence with Mike Westbrook's Parade from his classic 1967 album Celebration, and then we played Loose Tubes' Yellow Hill from 1990. It's from a live gig at Ronnie Scott's Club in London and features the likes of Django Bates, Ian Ballamy, Mark Lockhart and countless others. And it's just been reissued on an album, Dancing on Frith Street. I'm Kevin Legendre and you're listening to Jazz Lineup. Now for the final part of our conversation with two other British musicians, Tommy Smith and Guy Barker, talking about the big band in jazz. And Guy was keen to point out that the writing process can often be a labour of love.
Certain jazz musicians do become fascinated by the composing process, and when you do something, I mean, you'll remember that, Tommy. When you write one of your first charts for a big band and it works, it's the most thrilling feeling because you've done all the work, you've locked yourself away, you've done it all, and then you present it to a band, and then they play it, say, the first time, second time, third time, and suddenly it comes alive. It can become a kind of, you get hooked on it, you know. And I mean, I remember talking to an Australian composer, and I said, well, I've got this band, and it's three trumpets, three trombones, and four saxes. And he said, why? I said, well, yeah, it works. It's light, you know, it's nice. Why haven't you got four or five trumpets and five saxophones? And he'd gone, he was in the next stage on, and that's how it works, you know. Then you start writing for an orchestra, and all of this stuff is there that you can try things out with, and it becomes an obsession and a fascination, as well as bloody hard work. But
Tommy, you're going to be working with John Scofield and also Gary Burton, and a couple of gigs that are coming up. Can you give us a sneak preview of what we might expect, assuming that you don't change your mind before you get to the stage?
Well, with Sco, we've got there's 10 pieces that we commissioned for him, 5 of his pieces and 5 of the late Electric Miles period, and unfortunately we're playing one set. I mean, we're fortunate to be featured in the festival. I mean, we're very proud and happy and lucky to be invited here to play. And for example, last night we played Woody Herman. And we played a track from 1933, and playing in that style, bit of bass drum on every beat, and playing in the center, and we even tried to play some of the solos from that period. It's very, very difficult. Next night, Electric Miles, you know, no vibrato. We're using no vibrato. We're Sco plays a little bit behind the beat, so we've got to be careful with our big band not to be too on top. We're kind of like a chameleon, our big band, because we do so many different things. And the thread of the story is in front of me, but is nebulous and becoming more and more cloudy. So what was your question again, Kevin?
Whether you could give us a sneak preview of what you're going to play, but let's not worry about that. I mean,
well, we're going to open up with Wabash the Third, which is a Scofield composition, and then we're going to do Groove Elation, and then we're going to do Tutu, and then we're going to do Go Blow by Sco, and then we're going to do Splatch by Miles. And then we're going to finish off, if the audience want more, with another composition, which will remain nameless, not because I've forgotten, just because we've got to keep something. And with Gary, we worked last September with him, so we did 5 concerts. We even went as far up as Inverness, and we did the music of Wayne Shorter. And so we did some of his most famous works, like Speak No Evil, and Yes or No, Nefertiti, and one contemporary work, Virgo Rising. And again, we're going to play 6 pieces out of the 10. And it's just great to see these soloists play with our orchestra. It's very inspiring for us, and that effect lasts a long time, and the musicians really grow and have an incentive to move forward and reach new goals because of their experience with these players.
Great. So we have something to look forward to. I think we're going to end with just a little piece of music which will remind us of this great tradition which these two gentlemen are celebrating and extending. This is Duke Ellington, but let me just invite you all to thank again Tommy Smith and Guy Barker for being so generous and taking time out to talk to us for the London Jazz Festival. So Guy and Tommy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is BBC Radio 3 and I'm John Shea with Music Through the Night. In this part of today's programme, recordings by current or recent Radio 3 New Generation artists. Sharon Bazali plays Bach flute sonatas, Jennifer Pike plays Janáček's violin sonata, Andrew Kennedy sings songs by Benjamin Britten, and Eduard Kuntz rounds things off with Bartók's Suite for Piano. The American violinist Ty Murray joined the scheme in 2008, and the title of the piece she's playing here may be misleading. That is, if you don't know that Le Roi des Urnes is the French name for the Earl King, made poetically famous by Goethe and musically so by Schubert. The song's melody and its nightmarish piano accompaniment are both reallocated here to the solo violin. Thank you. A century before Henry James wrote about a child possessed by demonic forces in The Turn of the Screw, Goethe broached the subject in his poem Der Erlkönig. Schubert's famously chilling setting of it was transcribed there for solo violin by Heinrich Wilhelm Ernst, a virtuoso much admired by Mendelssohn and Joachim, among others. Ty Murray was the violinist. Next, Sharon Bazzali plays Bach with Terence Charleston at the harpsichord. This is the sonata in A major.
Thank you.
Economically, if a little strangely, Bach wrote that flute sonata on the spare staves at the bottom of the page of a concerto for two harpsichords. His sonata in A, BWV 1032, was played by Sharon Bazzali with harpsichordist Terence Charleston. Jennifer Pike is our next Radio 3 New Generation artist, and with Tom Blach at the piano, she's playing Janáček's only surviving violin sonata. He began it in 1914, when we were expecting the Russians in Moravia, as he later explained, but it was only first heard many revisions later in 1922.
Thank you.